So is there a book that you read to your children, those of you who are parents, that your parents read to you? No. All the books my parents read were rubbish, so I don't read any of them. We have one in our house that I remember being read to me as a little boy that was probably read to my parents when they were little, The Pokey Little Puppy. It's a little golden book, and it's about these puppies that go and play, and there's one who's always behind, right? And then everybody gets called back for dinner, and the older brothers and sisters get caught for having escaped the yard, and so they have to go to bed without dessert, but dessert's left sitting out, so once he finally gets home, he gets to help himself to all the dessert because it's still out on the table. And then, of course, the end of the story, he gets caught, right? They wait for him. And everybody else has had dessert, and he doesn't get any. But that's a terrible example, because it's probably only about 60 years old or so. But I was talking to my students about this last week. You know, we do classical education, so the things we read are very, very old, most of them. And time has this way of filtering out the bits that aren't very good. Not all of them. There are some hymns from the 1800s that are genuinely terrible, that are still very familiar to us from the Second Great Awakening. Like, they're really, really bad. But they're some of our favorites, and so we sing them anyway. But often, right, the stories that just don't work, people don't repeat because they don't work. They're not any fun, right? It's like the jokes that we tell, right? There are some jokes that are ancient, and there are some jokes that you only hear once because nobody laughs when you tell them. So that's true of stories. A lot of the stories that we read, even ones that market themselves as new, are actually very, very old. But that's true of things beyond stories as well. That's true of songs, that's true of poems, and that's true of treatises. People who ponder theological questions, if they pondered them well, if they unfolded something in a brilliant or helpful way, other people copied them and passed them on to others. People referred to them when they wrote about them, and so they end up having a wide circulation. There's this story that's told, especially among some people who study the New Testament and study early Christianity or study other classical literature, and they suggest that the only reason we have the books we have and not others is through some accident of history. Right? 200 years later, somebody found a copy of this, and they're like, oh, and they wrote it down. And it's just an accident of what has survived. And that's not entirely false. It's telling you something false on the basis of true information about how quickly things fall apart, and sometimes the accidental nature of some documents that we have, right? Why do we have these letters that someone wrote and not something else? Why is there this treatise that enough people refer to that we know Jerome wrote it, but we don't have a surviving copy? But often, the things that make a big impact are copied and recopied and disseminated. They're read widely, and then they come down to us in more or less complete form. The preacher in Ecclesiastes tells us more than once, right, that there's nothing new under the sun. And sometimes we suggest from that means that there's nothing new we can learn. And I don't think that's what he's on about. Another way to look at it is that there's nothing that we wrestle with that has not been wrestled with before. And half of you are going to nod and say, that sounds right, that sounds true. And then another three or four of you are going to say, well, what about screen time? Who's ever had to worry about screen time with their kids before? And actually, if you go back and read You'll find that Socrates had very strong opinions about writing. And we shouldn't be writing things down. We should actually not teach our children how to read and write, because they'll forget how to remember things if they can just go pick it up anytime. We're worried about this generation that doesn't have to learn things because they can run a search on Google or they can pull it up on YouTube. But thousands of years ago, educators were worried about writing doing something very, very similar. One thing that means is burning questions that matter for us, that we are asking or maybe should be asking, are often questions that other people have dealt with. They've wrestled with them as people. They've wrestled with them as pastors. They've wrote about them. And they have great wisdom to pass on for us. So I intend for the next few weeks, and I have the session's permission, although, to take us through one of those works. It's by Athanasius, St. Athanasius of Alexandria. It's known to us in English as On the Incarnation. This is actually the second part of a two-part work. The first part is called Against the Pagans or Against the Gentiles or Contra Gentes in Latin. It's not read as often, so I may refer back to parts of it because it really is part of a two-part work. But Athanasius was first and foremost a pastor. He was a controversialist. He was a theologian. He was very much a politician. Some people think he was never actually very much more than a politician. I think they're wrong. I hope that you do too. We'll see. But he's first and foremost a pastor. So who can tell me something that you remember about Athanasius? You've heard before, or you're suspicious of him because, or his name is familiar from... There's a creed named after Athanasius, the Athanasian Creed. It's the really, really long one, right? 10-point font. Single-spaced, takes up an entire page. Anglicans say it once a year, and that's enough. It takes about a week. Anything else? Anything anyone else remembers? Or has heard somewhere? Read on the internet? Dale, was that a hand? Yeah, something... So do you and John remember anything about Athanasius? This is in class, some of my students, they've learned that they can't deliberately avoid eye contact. Some of them have not yet learned that if it's very obvious that they're not avoiding eye contact, I will still call on them. Who knows when Athanasius lived? Broadly speaking, we don't actually know when he was born. We've got a 5-year window. Yeah. So he was born somewhere around 295 or 300. We don't know for sure. I can't write. He's born somewhere around the turn of the century, and he dies in 373. What happens in the 4th century? Lots of things, but that comes a little bit later. Rome's fall is impending. Who are some people he overlaps with? I'm going to ask that, and that will help us remember what's happening around him. Augustine comes in as a young man around the time of his death. I'm going to cheat. I have an answer key. because I don't remember dates for people either. So Augustine was born 354. Let's use a different color for Augustine. Ooh, this is fancy. Oh, well, it doesn't work. Okay, so Augustine is roughly 354 to, I think, 430. I want to make him older than he was. Interestingly, Augustine, as a young man, a young Christian, he reads Athanasius' Life of Antony, which is about St. Anthony, the desert hermit monk, who had a profound influence on the development of monasticism. In a weird way, actually, because Anthony is one who goes out and lives by himself. Although a few people go out and live kind of by themselves, but with him. But he has a tremendous influence on monastic communities that come and gather and live together. So he practiced one kind of monasticism, but has an incredible influence. Probably no one more than Benedict had more influence on that movement than Antony, but over monks that gathered in communities. Augustine read that work written by Athanasius about Antony as a young man, and so his dream that is never fulfilled is to become kind of the Christian scholar living in isolation with other Christian scholars. And you would think from Augustine's work that he actually got to do that, and he didn't. He just was either preaching or writing or sleeping, and probably very little of the last. So he also overlaps with Arius. So Arius is probably in his 40s when Athanasius is born. Arius, how to put it? So there's, we'll jump forward a couple thousand years. So Hermann Gunkel was an Old Testament scholar in Germany. He had a student by the name of Sigmund Mowinckel. Initially they got on great, then as seemed to happen with everyone Hermann Gunkel knew, they parted ways and it became a very, very bitter relationship. And Mowinckel always insisted that everything he taught was only the logical conclusion of what he had learned from his teacher, Hermann Gunkel. And Hermann Gunkel actually put down in writing in one of his works, you know, just because something follows logically doesn't mean it's correct. So Arius, reading the New Testament in particular, suggested, and then after being told, no, that's wrong, continued to teach that the Son of God is somehow less than. So he would take a passage like the opening of Colossians, first chapter of Colossians, where it calls Jesus firstborn of all creation, and would say, ah, this is not about title or position. This is about the fact that he was actually the first of the creatures. And so he has this exalted position, but he is not God. He is a creature of God, which then impacts several different areas of theology, right? Among which, that means he's not eternal. He had a beginning point. And so as this theology gains some traction, and it does, it gains traction with the emperor, so it has imperial support as it spreads throughout the empire for a while. There are suggestions that Constantine was an Arian up until the end of his life. When, of course, right, all the great monarchs, they repent at the end of their life and believe in orthodoxy. That's the story that we tell, right? They come up with this little jingle that's really, really catchy to support the spread of this theology. There was when he was not. There was when he was not. Singing about the Son of God. And, of course, this is very alarming. to the church. But one also has to wonder, they have to wrestle with, why? Why is it alarming? Why does it bother us? Why is it not okay to believe this? There are lots of ways to answer that, right? What is Jesus doing accepting worship in John 9, for instance, if he is not God? Is that part of his exalted position, or is this language, does it mean something else? So Athanasius, very early in his career, he begins his career as an assistant to Bishop Alexander in Alexandria. So in the 320s, he is at one of the major councils, probably as Alexander's secretary. And then he succeeds Alexander to the bishopric, right? So he's in charge of the major church at Alexandria, and then also kind of oversees the region as a pastor. Now he comes out very strongly against Arianism, and because Arianism has the support of the emperor, that becomes, that makes trouble for Athanasius. So although he pastors the church at Alexandria for some 50 years or so, he spends probably better than 50% of that in hiding or on the run or in exile somewhere. So the book that we're going to go through together on the Incarnation, he probably writes in the early 330s. So he's been Bishop of Alexandria for a little bit, long enough to get exiled. He's probably somewhere in France. And as he says, at the beginning of part one against the Gentiles, he doesn't have his books with him. Now that may mean that he genuinely doesn't have his books with him because he's in exile. It may mean that he can't be bothered to look things up and write proper footnotes. Because this very curious thing happens as he writes both against the Gentiles and on the Incarnation. But especially the first part, he uses lines of argument that are 200 years old by his time. He's thoroughly conversant with the literature. So things argued by Justin, lines of reasoning used by Tertullian and several others, they're all throughout Athanasius' works at this point. But they're woven in such a way that we can't pick them out and say, in this paragraph, Athanasius is clearly dependent on this section of this person's argument. He actually does something very similar with Scripture. There are places where he's clearly quoting Scripture, places where he'll take like an entire paragraph out of John and repeat it in On the Incarnation with a few transitions or other words woven in. But there are other places where he's clearly using Psalm 110, but because he's paraphrasing and because he's woven it into the middle of an argument, it's very difficult to pick out what's actually part of the quotation and what's an allusion and the differences between those things. One of the... Well, how many of you have an interest already in church history? You're just bent that way. Okay, this will be an uphill battle. I had a great church history teacher in seminary, Andy Hoffecker. He's amazing. But I didn't really get the bug from him. It was later, as I was reading the Psalms, and I started looking at church fathers, and partly the way that they were reading was weird, but also very similar to how we read. And I was able to see, well, to stop and think about the fact that I'm reading over the shoulder of people who are reading the Bible, you know, a millennium and a half before I started reading the Bible. And there are so many things that I can learn from them. So many questions I thought maybe I was the first person that ever asked. How many of you have thought that about anything, right? And then you ask somebody, right, and they've been pondering it for 30 years, right? Yeah. One thing that really brought that home for me was in my work in Psalms. Most of you know, because I've told you 5 or 6 times, right, and your eyes glaze over after a couple minutes. Right? I'm very interested in the order that the Psalms are in. I think there's something deliberate about that, that it's on purpose. People have been asking that question for a while. But because of developments in the study of the Old Testament in the late 1800s, early 1900s, we kind of ignored that question for almost 100 years. People, you know, you can say something in English and it doesn't have the same effect as if you say it very pompously in German. And there were people saying very pompously in German, right, there is no answer to this question, and people who study it are very stupid. Right, that's not where the interesting bits of the Psalms lie. The interesting part is the categories, right, and what the categories tell us about the way Israel worshiped their God. And there are interesting questions and answers to be found there, but some of them were so fascinated with the categories that in their Psalms commentaries, they would rearrange the Psalter and put them, you know, chapter 1 is all of the laments, right, and chapter 2 is all of the hymns, and they would completely rearrange the Psalter. And that sounds really silly, but you can pick up books at Mardell that were written in English 10 years ago that do that very thing. When we found the Dead Sea Scrolls and began to study them, one of the things we found from Cave 11 was this huge Psalm scroll. It had almost the entire Psalter, but it had other things too. There were psalms we'd never seen before that were stuck in there, in between things that were psalms, with no signal that, hey, this is, you know, we're moving from a biblical psalm to, you know, something out of the hymn book here. But it was also very differently arranged. So from about Psalm 3 to 89 or so, they're in roughly the same order. And then what we have for the remainder of the Psalter, the order is very, very different. So people went, wow, maybe the order's on purpose. Why has nobody ever asked this question before? And so someone wrote a fantastic doctoral dissertation in 1981, published in 1985 as The Editing of the Hebrew Psalter, right? The most interesting title ever. And he goes through and compares the order in that Psalm scroll to the order that we have, that we've received. It looks at what the editors may or may not have been doing and the things that they use as their categories for placement. And some of you are starting to fall asleep. But this generated huge interest starting in the mid-1980s, having ignored this question since probably the 1900s, maybe 1890s. All of a sudden, people are saying, what if this order is on purpose? What if it's not just that Psalm 1 comes after Psalm 2 and they're deliberately tied together, but what if Psalm 29 is between Psalm 28 and Psalm 30 on purpose? And there's actually something going on. What if the movement from Psalm 22 with the one who's forsaken to the movement into Psalm 23 with the Lord is my shepherd and then into Psalm 24 where the earth and all it contains belongs to the Lord. What if that's deliberate? What if there's a message to that? Then in the late 90s, early 2000s, Patrick Miller published an article about Gregory of Nyssa. Because way back about 370, maybe 365, Gregory of Nyssa, so Patrick Miller published this article. And it's about Gregory of Nyssa, who overlaps kind of with the tail end of Athanasius' life. He's a younger brother of Basil the Great, who's very well known. Gregory of Nyssa should be better known than he is. And then their best friend, Gregory of Nazianzus, is probably better known than Gregory of Nyssa. And those three together are called the great Cappadocians, or the three Cappadocians. They all pastored in Asia Minor, what's now Turkey. They wrote a great deal on the Trinity and especially on the Holy Spirit. But Gregory of Nyssa begins, but never finishes, a work on the Book of Psalms and how it's ordered and why it's ordered that way. And he looks at it and says, the way he's trained to read is to say the opening line of something, but especially its opening word, gives you the key to its interpretation. It unlocks what this thing is about. So he looks at the Psalter, and he looks at Psalm 1, and the first word is blessed, right? Blessed is the man. We've found a way to keep that word first in English. And he says, aha, the Psalter as a whole is about blessedness. It's about leading us on a journey to greater and greater beatitude, so that at the end of the Psalter, where everything that has breath praises the Lord, we're finally drawn up into the beatific vision, and we're beholding God face to face. And so he writes this work where he starts out looking not just at Psalm 1, but looking at the headings that we always skip, right, that are in small caps. He says, these inscriptions give us key information about what each psalm is about. And then each psalm then continues to build in this journey toward the beatific vision. It's beautiful and interesting and a little bit weird, but Patrick Miller kind of calls everyone on their bluff and says, this question that we think we've only been chasing for 20 years, that everyone is an idiot, like, why did we never ask this before? Not only have we been asking it, you know, since the beginning of reading the Psalms, but someone took a very serious swing at answering it and gave an intelligent, clear, and compelling answer in the late 4th century. So for me, sitting, you know, in my cubicle in the library working on the Book of Psalms, reading Old Testament, and you know, I'm overwhelmed by all these things I have to read, and most of them are in German, right? To have him say, you know, there's something that's thoroughly relevant to your research question that's a millennium and a half old, on the one hand, was a little bit overwhelming. And it might be part of why I haven't finished. But it was also really eye-opening. Because to be able to step back and not just be looking at these texts and hearing other voices, but to realize that there were people in a world not that different from the world of the writers of the New Testament who were reading and interpreting and writing about these things in compelling pastoral and important ways. That, I think, is when I really caught the bug for church history and reading the church fathers, especially. To know that I'm not just dependent on people who've been reading the Bible for the last 100 years, but these people have been reading and applying the Bible in intelligent ways, you know, before King Arthur, if there was a King Arthur, right? Before Beowulf, right? Before Rome pulled out of Great Britain, there were people asking these questions. There were people reading these texts and writing about them. And we can actually go pick them up and read them and learn a great deal from them. So I found that fascinating. I hope that you're hearing this and catching some of the bug. And we'll walk through Athanasius, but one book that does a really good job at kind of laying that out and drawing you into this is a book by Christopher Hall. It's called Reading Scripture with the Church Fathers. And what he does is he picks four or five of these guys and walks you through how they read the Bible, ways that they read it, particular characteristics of their method, but also big chunks. So you get to read them. You get to read over his shoulder as you read over, as he reads over their shoulder, as they're reading the Bible and applying it to their people. So he takes, I've forgotten which interpreters. So he talks a little bit about interpretation in particular, or in general, sorry, and then about who the church fathers were. And then he takes four of the great doctors of the church in the East and four from the West and kind of gives you a taste for how they read the Bible. So he takes Athanasius, Gregory of Nazianzus, Basil the Great, and John Chrysostom. And he also kind of wrestles out loud in the book, well, why didn't you pick this person and why not that person? So, and then from the West, Ambrose, Jerome, Augustine, and Gregory the Great. There's so many Gregories in church history. This is the one who was Pope in the 500s, I think 500s, so, who wrote the Great Tome, which is really good. You should read that too. And then he also talks about this this tension that I think does exist but is largely talked about just in caricature between the way people read the Bible in Alexandria and the way people read the Bible in Antioch. So they read the Bible so similarly that it's a bit disingenuous to characterize them differently and put them in opposition. But you do have two rival schools that do, because they read the Bible so similarly, they have to distinguish themselves from the other. And it does become a source of tension in biblical interpretation, in the development of the creeds, and in the politics of the church. So, what questions do you all have so far? Questions, comments? Are you excited about reading Athanasius? Some of you. So the story that's told, often by people who haven't read examples of interpretation from either, is that in Alexandria, you have this practice of wild, loose, no basis in the text allegory. That everything is an allegory, and they have no actual interest in the particulars of the text. Whereas at Antioch, you have very careful, very deliberate eschewing of allegory and a focus on the literal meaning of the text. That's unfair and untrue. They both use allegory. They both are very interested in the literal meaning of the text. And we've also been lied to in the way we talk about how the fathers read the Bible. And this is maybe one of the things that kept me from reading the church fathers for so long. Because the lie that we're told is that they see things in the text that aren't there, because their primary mode for reading the text is allegory. And the way they do allegory is there are no controls. There are no controls whatsoever. There are no rules. They see in the text what they want to see there, and it may have more to do with what they ate last night than with what's on the page. All of that's a lie. All of that's a lie. So Origen is an example. Now, there are places where allegorical readings do go awry, right? To leave you thinking that all allegory makes perfect sense and is completely controlled, that would also be a lie, right? But their interpretation, when it's done at its best, moves through different levels. And honestly, a good evangelical preacher does these things. Mike does these things on a Sunday morning. There's careful attention to the text. What's in the text? What is the text about? If it's historical, what events are it grounded in? What's it talking about? From that, right, are there moral lessons that we're supposed to draw from the examples in this text? Right? Are there things that characters do that we should not do? Are there things that the biblical characters do that we shouldn't? That's what I just said. Right. Are there things we should do? Are there things we should not do that we can see? Or especially, can we see the consequences of choosing wrongly unfolded in the text? Are there things in the text that teach us what we should think about God? Are there things the text teaches us about Christ? Right? So how is the Exodus not just about the Israelites leaving Egypt and freedom from slavery? How is the Exodus also about freedom from sin? And what does it teach us about the ways God delivers that are true for us? And then there's more to it than that, but essentially those are the levels, and each of those levels should be grounded in the other so that it's not just wildly off the charts, right? There's a bush, and that's, bushes are plants, and the cross was carved from a tree, which was also a plant, and so this bush is a picture of the crucifixion, right? And that's kind of the story we tell about the way they read the text. But you do have, probably, there's a long line of development of scholarship on Greek texts in Alexandria that predates the church. And the church fathers who lived or worked or studied in Alexandria are caught up into that culture. So there's a long history of how do we read these texts at Alexandria. And the school that develops in Antioch develops later. So those who study in Alexandria have that long tradition that they're building on. A tradition that had Greek scholars reading Homer saying, this is terrible. Who would believe in gods that would do these things? Surely our gods are not so base as this. So obviously these are, you know, we need to read Homer allegorically because we can't believe what Homer says about our gods. That would be awful, right? So a tension does develop between Alexandria and Antioch. And Alexandria, and a lot of it has to do with the person of Christ. And it's a while before things are reconciled. And there are tensions between East and West that come out of this. So Arius is more popular in the East for very much longer than he is in the West. So Athanasius kind of wins the day for the Western church by the end of his life. But it's a while longer before Arianism is stamped out in the Eastern church. Part of it has to do with the difference of language between Latin and Greek. And the Eastern church especially, right, there are multiple errors that you can make with the persons of God, with the Trinity. One is to say, really, there's just one. And the other is to say, you know, really, there's actually three. And it's very difficult for the church to navigate this. And so when Athanasius and his friends insist on God the Son being of the same substance as the Father, not like substance, but same substance, alarm bells go off, especially in the Eastern Church, this sounds like Sibelius. This sounds like we're making the error of collapsing the triune God into one. And so we don't like this language. We don't want to use this language. And because of things going on in the West, Athanasius and his mates want to insist on the language of the same substance. And so some of this is rooted in the schools, and some of it in the politics, and some of it with where different problems pop up. But there is this tension that lasts, and that's a long way from talking about, well, what is the caricature of Alexandria and Antioch, but that's in the background too. So one thing that happens is as the reformers seek to reform the church and argue against medieval interpretation, right, they always pick the worst examples to pick on. Never mind that if you turn the page, right, Calvin is doing in his commentaries what he's criticizing in the Institutes or on the previous page of his commentary. Calvin does fourfold interpretation, the sensus plenior, that he criticizes examples of in his commentaries. He does it carefully. He does it deliberately, and he grounds it in the details of the text. But that's a soapbox I probably should step off of for the moment. Yeah. Let's talk about the book. So I would highly, highly, strongly encourage you to read along with us. This is probably the best translation available by John Behr, B-E-H-R. John Behr, his translation of On the Incarnation. It's in the Popular Patristics series. It's a newer translation. It replaces a translation in the series that I don't think we know who did. I think they left it anonymous. It's just a religious of a certain order. And this is the one that had C.S. Lewis's famous introduction that I'll read the first line of in a bit. They kept that preface in the new translation, so you won't miss C.S. Lewis, regardless of which one you pick up. This translation has the advantage of being available in English and Greek on facing pages. So if you read Greek or want to learn Greek, that would be the one to pick up. You can also get it with just the English. This older translation has the advantage of having Athanasius' letter to Marcellinus on the interpretation of the Psalms as an appendix. And that's one of the top five things I've ever read about the Book of Psalms. He writes to a monk, a monk who is recovering from illness and in that time is trying to learn how to read the Psalms, writes to Athanasius for advice. And Athanasius writes him a letter about how to read the Psalms. When you're in this mood, read this Psalm. When your heart is feeling this way and you need to direct your heart, these are the Psalms that you should read. When you want to give God thanks for good wine, right? Read this Psalm. And there's so much along the way about how the Psalter is like a little Bible, how it's like a garden full of all of this variety, how it's a healing potion for the soul, how it's a mirror that reflects us back to ourselves and brings all of the emotions that we experience before the throne of grace and teaches us how to pray. So I might, if you've picked up this translation but would like to read that letter, I'll see if we can get a copy of it that we can send out to you. If you like to read off of a screen or find something for free and print it off, you can also find a much older translation of Athanasius on the Christian Classics Ethereal Library, which you should know about. Calvin College has gathered lots and lots and lots of Christian texts that are in the public domain and put them up on a website for free. That's ccel.org. And I'll write that down. So you can find it for free there. You can find his Against the Pagans there if you want to read it as well. Or if you're coming on a Sunday morning and you forgot your paper copy, you could probably pull that up on your phone as we talk about it as well. One nice thing is that the paragraphs are numbered consistently across all of the translations that I know, so that we could say, you know, we're looking at paragraph 3 instead of giving you a page number, and then no matter which translation you have, we could all be looking at the same paragraph, even though the wording would be very different. One thing to know about this twofold work that we're looking at the second part of, Against the Pagans and On the Incarnation, is although he's talking about those people out there, right, and he's writing in a world where although Christianity is on the rise, right, there's still a very, very strong and intellectual pagan resistance to Christianity, as well as all of this turmoil within the church as we're trying to sort out what it is that we believe and why. He's writing about those things, but as a pastor to believers. Now, he's being read by people of every stripe and every creed, but his primary audience is you. As he writes about paganism and why it's wrong and actually what things there are about it that's true, that point us to the truth, he's not writing to the pagans. He expects the pagans will probably pick it up and read it at some point, but he's writing to you, right? He's writing to believers in the church who need to know these things and need to be strengthened against the lies that they're being told. He writes to you as people in the church who hear all of these different theological ideas and need to know not just the truth, but why it's important and what difference does it make, right? Why does it matter to me as I work my 9-to-5 job Monday through Friday, and then, you know, Saturday I play with the kids and Sunday I come to worship and then take a nap? Like, why do I care that Jesus was fully divine, right? How does that affect my life? And he'll tell you. And it's glorious. So, one thing C.S. Lewis says as he begins his introduction, that if the rest of this hasn't caught you yet, maybe this will. He says, there's a strange idea abroad that in every subject the ancient books should be read only by the professionals, and that the amateur should content himself with the modern books. He, of course, thinks that's perfect rubbish. As a professional who read those books and also taught those books to students, he goes on to make the point that actually usually those old books are much easier to read and understand than the books written about them. So, bearing in mind, right, that Athanasius writes about things that matter to us, and he's written something that has been copied and reread and then retaught and then reread and recopied and retranslated over and over because people over a millennium and a half have found it so relevant, something that matters to them, something that resonated with them. I hope that will draw you in. And I hope, right, you're welcome to just come and hear us talk about it, but I hope that you'll also be motivated to read them for yourself. Because I suspect you'll see things in Athanasius that I haven't seen, and I would love to hear that. I would love to learn from you as we read through it together. Ann Taylor's late. She should have been in here already to tell us we're done. Yes? So the short version is I want you all to catch a bug for reading the Church Fathers. Yeah. But why Athanasius specifically? Why this work? Because it's so profound. Because Athanasius has things to tell you about your salvation and about how wonderful and amazing it is. And they're things that we don't normally think about. Salvation in Christ, union with Christ, the benefits we draw from that is so, so much more and so much richer than a get-out-of-hell-free card. And often, especially in our cultural context, not just our church context, but here in the middle of the Bible Belt, that's often we see salvation one of two ways, right? Either it's a get-out-of-hell-free card, or it's a, right, if you have enough faith, you have everything you want right now, right? And that the truth is so much more beautiful and more compelling than that, which Athanasius unfolds in a way that I hope would give you a fresh vision of the beauty of Christ and also make you want to read more of Athanasius, but also cause you to love Jesus more. So.
Tony, are you going to provide any kind of meeting schedule or anything so that we're kind of prepared for what you're going to talk about?
So, that's a good question. The numbered paragraphs are usually grouped into like about six groups. So we could go 6 weeks, but I suspect we'll slow down for that. So I would say for next week, read the prologue, which is just paragraph one. And then John Baer has broken down. I don't know if it's broken down in other translations. He has paragraph one and then paragraphs 2 through 10. 11 through 19, and then others. So it's about between 9 and 12 paragraphs at a time. And he moves through it, and he breaks it down into six sections. So I think it will probably take longer than 6 weeks. But I would say if you intend to read along, or even if you don't, maybe give it a try and see if you end up sticking with it. Why don't we read the first paragraph for next week? Read the introduction in whatever copy, whatever translation you have, and then read Athanasius' first paragraph, because he'll tell you what it is he wants to tell you. Mike?
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes, absolutely. Please. Okay. Does that include this week? Okay, yeah. So today is part one of section one, which is the prologue that we didn't read yet. So read paragraph one for next week, and we'll get into not just talking about Athanasius and his background, but actually start getting into his work. And something I mentioned earlier to think about, if it's true, because Athanasius read texts this way too, if it's true that the first line or the first word unlocks the key to its interpretation, now you're reading it in English translation, not in Greek, but how does he open this work? And does that give you a clue to what he's writing about and why he thinks it's important?
So.
Yeah, so that we're finishing his discussion of the incarnation right as we get ready to celebrate the incarnation. So, all right. Well, thank you.